Good evening, everybody. Could I welcome you all here this evening, and especially welcome our distinguished guest, Professor Ulrich Beck. Professor Beck isn't really a visitor to the LSE because he's more of a regular faculty member. He comes every year around about this time of year and does some seminar teaching and is generally a valued member of the LSE intellectual community. In Germany, Professor Beck is Professor of Sociology at the University of Munich. Ulrich Beck is known in the early part of his writings, especially for a highly celebrated book called Risk Society. Risk Society, I think everybody in the social sciences agrees, broke major new ground, was published in the mid-1980s. You open a newspaper today, you see references to risk everywhere. Global warming, BSE, risk of collapse of financial markets. But in the mid-1980s, people didn't really think like that. This was the first book, I think, to systematically show why the notion of risk is so important to us. In the book, Ulrich showed that it's important for two reasons, really. One is the disappearance of nature. The invasion of nature by science and technology creates new risk situations which we've never had to face before. And the second change is the transformation of tradition, custom. Our lives become much more open than they ever were before. The more you face an open future, the more you necessarily think in terms of risk. Things have moved on so much since the mid-1980s that it's a bit hard to recover how prescient that book was, but it still is one of the major texts, I think, of sociology of the past 25 years. In a sense, he was at the mid-phase of his career, together with his wife, Elizabeth Beck-Gunsheim. Ulrich wrote a book called The Normal Chaos of Love, which is about personal relationships, marriage, sexuality. In that book, he showed that the changes affecting the large-scale institutions of the world are reflected in our personal lives, in our emotional lives, in the relationships we form with one another. Love has become a normal chaos because it's no longer institutionalized. Marriage doesn't have the same structure as it did in the past. There's a tremendous revolution going on in personal life, which was brilliantly diagnosed in that book. Later on, Ulrich wrote a book called Reflexive Modernization, in which I played a humble part too. We were sort of co-authors of this text. Also very relevant to what's going on in the world now, because in the book, Ulrich argues that in earlier phases of industrial development, you had a consistent set of processes of modernization, which weren't really understood by those involved in them. They sort of took people by surprise. Now, reflection, thought, consciousness, conscious attempt to organize the future is part and parcel of what modernization is. That's what reflexive modernization means. It's modernization which constantly looks at itself, examines its own processes, and also assesses the risks that it creates. This transformation is so clear in the current discussion of globalization, where you could not get a more self-conscious experience shared around the world, but also dissected, analyzed, looked at by so many different people all around the world as part of the very process itself. This is the backdrop to his lecture tonight, which is about, essentially, as I understand it, the emergence of a more cosmopolitan world. And I think it's called, if I remember properly, Power in the Global Economy, or something quite close to that. Ladies and gentlemen, I give you Professor Ulrich Beck.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It's a pleasure being here again and having the opportunity to talk to you. It's a pleasure and an honor, of course, being part of this vital intellectual culture. Thank you, Tony, for your kind introduction. I finally got the proof that you really read the books. I've never been sure before, but I could have listened to you just going on like this. But now it's my part to pick it up. For sometimes now I find myself asking such stupid, huge questions like the one today. How to redefine power in the global economy. Let's handle this for 5 or 6 minutes and then get on to some other topic. Why those big questions again? I'm working on a distinction between first and second modernity, which is close to the concept of reflexive modernization. And I'm doing this not only in a theoretical and philosophical context, but in the context of a research institute which we have in Munich now, in detail research projects. First modernity is based on what I call methodological nationalism. That is, the assumption of nationalism are built into our basic consumptions of the social sciences. And even if you ask for transnational data, for example, you will find that most of our statistical work, our empirical data, is still based on nation-state assumptions. And what we need, and as I said, I'm working on it in detail projects as well, is what I call a methodological cosmopolitanism. That is, we have to redefine our basic concepts of the social sciences in a cosmopolitan frame of reference, and therefore those somehow very difficult to answer huge questions. Let's exercise this. How can or must the concept of power and dominance and authority be redefined in a cosmopolitan frame of reference? I have 8 theses. First thesis: the relationship between world economy and the state now reassembles a meta power. That is, the power to change the rules of the national and international power. The economy in particular has gained its meta power because it has broken out of the cage of territorially and nationally organized and dominated power conflict and has acquired new power moves in the digital space. So by meta power game, I mean playing for the power while simultaneously changing the national nation state rules of power. It is like playing chess and changing the rules of the game along the way. The pawn, the economy, suddenly becomes the knight, given the new possibilities of mobility by information technology, and can thus checkmate the king, the state. But suddenly the state may also begin to jump and thus checkmate the knight economy in new ways too, etc. From what do capital strategies draw their new meta power? The basic principle was summed up in the headline of an East European newspaper on the occasion of the visit of the German Chancellor. It said, "We forgive the crusaders and evade the investors." It is precise the opposite of the classical theory of power and authority, which maximizes the power of transnational corporations. The threat is no longer of an invasion, but of the non-invasion of investors, or the threat of their withdrawal. There's only one thing worse than being overrun by big multinationals, not being overrun by big multinationals. This kind of authority is no longer tied to the execution of orders, but rather to the possibility of going somewhere else, to other countries to make better investments. It thus introduces the threat of not doing something, that is, of not investing in this country. The new global economic power of big business is thus, in this sense, not founded on violence as the ultimate rational force, to force their will upon others, it's precisely this which makes it so much more mobile, that is, not tied to any specific location and consequently globally disposable. While the power of the state, according to the national rational, grows by conquering foreign territories, the power of the global economy's players grows precisely by doing or threatening to do the opposite, by being in a position to leave the relevant national territory, to not conquer foreign countries. This, in turn, succeeds to the extent that transnational companies become extraterritorial factors. The power of the state is thus not undermined or broken by state power, that is, military threat and conquest, but deterritorially, exterritorially, by the way of a new whitelessness of transnational trade and activity in the digital space. This deterritorial conception of power reverses the logic of traditional understanding of power, violence, and authority. Not imperialism, but non-imperialism, not invasion, but the retreat of investors, constitutes the nucleus of power of global economic power. The deterritorialized power of business need neither to be politically obtained nor legitimate. Its implementation avoids the institution of developed democracy, such as parliament, the courts, the government. The formula of this power is deliberate non-conquest. This non-violent, invisible, intentional threat of withdrawal or inaction is neither conditional upon consent nor even capable of achieving it. The analogy between the military rational of power and the economic rational of power is evident. Investment capital is the equivalent of firepower. With a big difference, the threat of not firing enlarges the power. Product development subsidized by the state is the equivalent of weapon innovation. Taxes can be defense strategies protecting local and national market against global invaders, investors. Offense is the best defense, and that means research and development force-fed with government support and taxpayers' money increases the offensive power of global capital. And of course, ideological worship has been replaced by the discourse on globalization. On the one hand, you can, as I did, explain the concept of global matter power by reversing the classical concept of state power, as, for example, Max Weber defines it. On the other hand, the first and most important victory of globalization may be the globalization of the globalization discourse. And this discursive power of globalization can be understood in Foucault's theory of power, which differs greatly from classical definition of power and focus on power over others, that focus on power over others and which assumes clear agency. The power of not investing capital is something which exists everywhere. Globalization is not a choice. It is a nobody's rule. No one is in charge. No one started it. No one can stop it. It is a kind of organized irresponsibility. You keep looking for someone who is responsible you can complain to, but there is nobody on the other side of the phone. No email address. So the more the globalization discourse dominates through the discursive identity construction all areas of life, including the self-definition of one's own life in term of self-entrepreneurship, the more powerful capital strategies get. This does not mean, as I said before, that managers are ruling the world. Two often unseen consequences of this meta power of global economy are really remarkable. So far throughout history, the rules of the game in world politics have been bloody and imperialistic. The new global meta power is in its essence pacifistic, maybe not in its consequences.
The power of global capitalism derives from potential non-conquest. Of course, global capital has to be localized somewhere. And so it is imperialistic at the same time. But it is a kind of imperialism which the invaded, even if they don't like it at all, vitally depend upon. Second, at least in a special sense, cosmopolitan corporations and maybe even cosmopolitan capitalism is in the making. Global corporations are using and developing the productivity of diversity. The mixing of races, ethnic groups, and nationalities at home and abroad is becoming their central resource for creativity and at the same time a dominant employment policy of transnational corporations. The antidote against stagnation is hybridization. Mélange is the norm, at least inside of transnational government organizations and corporations. It is exactly the growing matter power of capital which sets companies free to diversify their workforce, often against national laws and national agency. So global corporations are transnational societies en miniature. Talking about even the possibility of a coming of a pacifistic and cosmopolitan capitalism may sound more than illusionary. Of course, old-fashioned territorial struggles continue in many parts of the world and may even get new importance in the near future, as the election of Sharon in Israel indicates, and the plans of the Bush administration to enforce new anti-missile defense systems which allows the U.S. to attack without being attacked. But in the central arenas of economic globalization, where transnational corporations, organizations, and states both compete and collaborate, war has become almost unthinkable. Both military power and diplomacy lost their importance. Of course, not all states are equally included, equable, capable of participation in the new global power game. So there are even in between states different kinds of losers and winners. As I said, the concept of meta power implies changing the rules of the game by playing it. So the old territorial and the new deterritorialized power game are overlapping, contradicting, and penetrating each other. What we are talking about are very ambivalent processes and open-end scenarios. But in fact, the old categories of state, of state-centered power and politics are becoming zombie categories. They do not capture the new actors, strategies, resources, goals, conflicts, paradoxes, and ambivalent outcomes of the matter power, both inside and between nations. After the nightmare of the 20th century, we have to expect the worst. But we have to recognize realistically, too, that through all the confusion and threats, the rising power of capital is changing the rules of state power, but doing this in maybe a pacifistic way, without democratic legitimation and with some translegal means at the same time. Second thesis. What does translegal mean? The metapower derives its subjects, its dynamics of conflict, its forms of development and unpredictable consequences, particularly because in this way the boundary between politics and economics is broken up, strategically negotiated, redrawn, and redefined. To pick up one example, the state monopoly of lawmaking is being privatized. Legal changes are the order of the day in advanced capitalist society as much as in former socialist one, and in the countries of Africa, Asia, Latin America, which are reshaping their legal norms and institutions under the regime of International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. So the state no longer enjoys a monopoly over the production of law. A range of new actors, corporate law firms, arbitration bodies, lex mercatoria, international institutions and NGOs are contributing to the diversity of forms of regulation, to the variety of settings of rule creation and application of norms and standards. Law is both privatized and transnationalized. In structuring processes of transnationalization, just as it's being shaped through them. Thus, property rights, patent laws, environmental laws, and human rights are the key areas in which the boundaries between national and transnational contexts are blurred, disappear, and are remixed. Transnational corporations and organizations thus become private as if states. They make collectively binding decisions. But at the same time, they mutate into fictitious decision makers, virtual organizations. One essential consequence is old enterprises were regulated by the principle of market and hierarchy. Their power and their decision were economically determined and limited so that the burden of legitimation was removed. But nowadays, corporations as quasi-states also have to make political decisions, and they are at the same time fundamentally depend on negotiation and trust, and thus become thoroughly dependent on legitimation. Furthermore, they become legitimation-dependent players without being able to draw on public state democratic sources of legitimation. As a result, there is a chronic need for trust on the part of the global players of the economy. World markets become extremely unstable. So there's an interesting paradox coming up, which can be used by the NGOs and new social movements. High power and low legitimation, as it is the case of the economy, is confronted by low power and high legitimation on the side of the NGOs. They can utilize it to develop their specific legitimation power, and they surely do. The as-if statehood of transnational economic metapower, the scope and bindings of force of the norms of world economy become evident not at least from the fact that these norms are conceived globally and thus, so to speak, include nation states as local executive organs. This is what Renato Ruggregio, the general director of the World Trade Organization, was referring to when he said in 1997, I quote, we are writing the constitution of a single global economy. It is a neoliberal project which anticipates globally binding decisions. Accordingly, a universally valid and applicable policy mix is being propagated. According to this, political reforms are to be geared to the standards of economic goals: low inflation, balanced budget, the dismantling of trade barriers and currency controls, maximum freedom for capital, minimum regulation for national labor market, and a lean welfare state which pushes its citizens into work. These are the reform goals of globally active neoliberalism. In this way, economic power remains non-political because adjustment to the international economy has become the internal compass of the ruling politics. So we are not living at the end of politics, but in a time of translegal metapolitics. The neoliberal regime represents a global reform policy. It envisions a borderless world, not for labor, but for capital. This is becoming a self-fulfilling prophecy, and through the structural reform policy initiated by the IMF and the World Bank. Neoliberal futures are being contested on many grounds. I just want to pick up two less familiar criticisms. First, the distinction between mobility and migration. Second, the question whether the neoliberal regime is capable of reproducing itself. In the nation-state paradigm of first modernity, there's a razor-sharp distinction between migration and mobility. Indeed, opposite values are typically assigned to the two. Population shifts within a national state meant mobility and were highly desired, especially in view of regional balances in the labor market. Mobility between national states, on the other hand, are regarded as migration and subjected to major restrictions. At the border post, desirable flexibility thus turns into undesirable migration. And the people who do what is so much demanded within individual countries find themselves being criminalized. They are economic refugees, assumed seekers, or illegal immigrants who put themselves in the hand of human traffickers, a task discharged within each country by the official employment exchange office. How can citizens who believe in universalistic values and rights become, within a transnational dimension, enemies of the very mobility for which they instantly call inside of their own country? Why then does nobody talk about capital migration, but only about capital mobility? There are well-grounded arguments that the neoliberal regime is not capable of reproducing itself. Major elements of instability are financial instabilities, the series of financial crises in Asia, South America, Russia, or in emerging markets, unemployment, fragile employment, jobless growth, inequality, poverty, and exclusion within and between countries, and the nexus to conflict, security risks, and withdrawal of investors. Global environmental and technological risks. The downward trend of corporate taxes and the instability to finance common goods nationally and globally. Finally, tensions between capitalism and political freedom, the market and democracy. For such challenges of what I call the world risk society, deregulation, liberalization, and privatization provide no remedy. In fact, for such hazards, the neoliberal regime is counterproductive. Without taxation, no infrastructure. Without taxation, no proper education, no affordable health care. Without taxation, no public sphere. Without a public sphere, no legitimacy. Without legitimacy, no conflict management and no security. To close the circle, without forums and forms of regulated, that is, recognized and non-violent handling of conflicts, both nationally and globally, there will be no economy whatsoever. Third thesis. This reveals a central paradox of the neoliberal model of state and politics. On the one hand, it is orientated to the ideal image of the minimalist state, whose responsibility and autonomy are to be tailored on the enforcement of norms of global economy. The state, as adjusted to the global market, has to be replaceable and exchangeable, has to compete with the largest possible number of similar states, is expected to have institutional internalized the neoliberal regime, and so on. On the other hand, however, deregulation of the market and privatization public assets does not mean a weak state. What is in prospect is a stronger state, for example, in matters of surveillance and repression. Chipping at habeas corpus or trial by jury, increasing prison sentences, stepping up border patrols, and being prepared for terrorism as the weapon of the weak. That is because legal order adjusted to the global economy must in turn be sanctioned by the state and defended against societal resistance. Above all, a state is needed capable of making absolutely certain that mobility of capital is not matched by any comparable mobility of labor. So another key paradox is globalization means reinventing borders, a tightening of border controls. Those new borders do not function like the old ones. They incorporate uncertainties because of flows of information, capital, and people. But because of the enforcement of new borders on a transnational level, the political power and autonomy of governments must not be curtailed in any way. Rather, states must be in a position to convince their societies to accept the transnational rules of power. To summarize this central paradox, in order to attain the goal of neoliberal restructuring of the world, the power of the state would have to be simultaneously minimized and maximized. Fourth thesis. Why do governments find it so difficult to exploit this paradox for the revitalization of democratic politics? As noted before, corporations, with the advantage of mobility and global network, are able to weaken individual states by playing them off against each other. This extension of the trans-legal rules works all the better the more national perspectives dominate the thinking and action of people and states. In other words, the national fixation of politics constitutes a decisive self-defeating mechanism. At this point, it is useful to introduce a differentiation between potential power and actual power in order to maximize the extent to which state strategies can be countered the force of capital strategies. The actual power of state is paralyzed by the twin self-defeating mechanism of neoliberalism and nationalism. Potential state meta-power, in turn, is created by the sum of strategies available to states and governments if they break with this mechanism, allowing the deterritorialized and denationalized states to open up to new transnational potentials of politics and control. Political answers to the newly emerging global economic geography can be found if conceptions and paths of a despatialization of state and politics and identity are developed and pursued. What does despatialization of state mean? Governments are essentially acting in a transnational space as soon as they negotiate binding international legal agreements or, as for example in the European Union, join together in newly transnational cooperative executives because the responsibilities they have taken impose an obligation to all of them concerned. This is how transnational forms of state cooperation create spaces of shared, interactive, cooperative sovereignty. This strategy, however, has its price. Under the conditions of economic globalization, states find themselves in a nationality trap. If they stick to the sovereignty postulate of nation-state politics, they both intensify the competition for investment between states and increase the risk of monopoly formation on the world market, which in turn weakens the state players. If, on the other hand, they reduce interstate competition by combining and imposing obligations to themselves in order to strengthen their position against the global economy, they necessarily qualify their own national sovereignty. This paradox illustrates a central experience of the cosmopolitan constellation. The elements which used to be combined in the national paradigm, national independence, national self-determination, and the solution of central national problems like welfare, justice, security, now become separated and opposed. Fifth thesis. In order to break free from this nationality trap, both in thought and action, it is vital to introduce a distinction between autonomy and sovereignty. Methodological nationalism is based on the equation of sovereignty and autonomy. From that point of view, cooperation between states automatically leads to loss of autonomy and hence loss of sovereignty. However, if sovereignty is equated with solving political problems, that is, creating economic growth, jobs, social security, etc., then increasing transnational state cooperation, that is, the loss of autonomy, results in a gain in sovereignty. Sharing sovereignty does not reduce sovereignty, but on the opposite, increases it. Trade-off the pooling sovereignty include security and stability, reducing anxiety and conflict, reduce military spending and economic and technological cooperation. Put differently, a loss of autonomy can mean cooperative and transnational solutions to urgent national problems, as migration, fall in tax revenue, unemployment, etc. So there is a national interest in denationalization, in sharing sovereignty in order to solve national problems. This insight is central to a cosmopolitan social science. A reduction in autonomy and a growth in sovereignty by no means logically excludes one another. They are in fact even capable of mutually strengthening each other. Globalization implies both an increase in the sovereignty of players, for example, through their potential act across borders and distances, and thus open up new options, while at the same time leading to a loss of autonomy of entire countries. That is to say, the process of globalization goes hand in hand with a shift from autonomy based on national exclusion to sovereignty based on transnational inclusion. The logic of the zero-sum game, as we know it from great powers, colonialism, economic and cultural imperialism, independent nation states and military blocs, loses its explanatory power. In other words, the new politics begins with breaking the national sound barrier. Sixth thesis. With that, the following question arises. How can the idea of the state, the theory of the state, be opened up to the challenge of the transnationalization of living and working conditions, the challenges of world risk society? The same question can also be put another way. Who is going to prevent the next Holocaust? My tentative experimental answer is possible the cosmopolitan state. The latter is founded on the principles of national indifference of state. Just as the Peace of Westphalia was able to end the religious civil European wars of the 16th and 17th century by separating state and religion, so the national world wars of the 20th century could be answered by a separation of state and nation. Just as only the non-religious state makes the practice of different religions possible, so the cosmopolitan state could guarantee the coexistence of national identities through the principle of constitutional tolerance. The curbing of national theology should lead to an redefinition of the scope and frame of action of the political, just as it did pushing back the Christian theology at the beginning of modern times in Europe. In the midst of 17th century, this was inconceivable or even synonymous with the end of the world. And today it's equally unthinkable for the theorist of the national, because it breaks with the basic idea of the political, the antagonism of friend and foe. And yet, following in the footsteps of Boudin, who defended the sovereignty of states from the intervention of religion and opened the former to history and politics, it would be possible to theoretically justify and politically develop this cosmopolitan sovereignty of state by two principles: the enablement of genuine diversity and being grounded upon human rights. As already emphasized, this does not imply the negation of the national, but to its very opposite, the facilitation of national diversity within the new constraints of the global. So what does the ancient adjective cosmopolitan mean, which has suddenly begun to glitter again? It is now possible to have both wings and roots, to develop meaningful affiliations without renouncing one's own origin. Rooted cosmopolitanism, you could call it. The adjective national presumes self-determination. The cosmopolitan question goes, self-determination, but against whom? How are the victims of self-determination integrated into it? How can we live together at the same time, both equal and different? How can we live together? How can we avoid having to choose between two destructive alternatives? Living together and setting aside our differences, or living apart in a homogeneous community which communicate only through the market or through violence? Only the post-nation, plural nation, nation-indifferent and nation-tolerant state can possibly overcome these destructive alternatives in the age of cultural globalization. So cosmopolitan means acknowledging both equality and difference. The cultural other must be present, heard, and have a voice in the community, culturally as well as politically. In the ears of those thinking in national terms, this sounds like completely unrealistic utopia. And yet many of its basic characteristics are already partly paid lip service, partly reality. Every country that puts democracy and human rights above autocracy and nationalism is already on the way to the cosmopolitan state. For me, it is thus only really possible to think Europe as a new kind of transnational, cosmopolitan, as if state structure, which draws its political strength precisely from the affirmation and taming of European diversity of nations. Europe as a cosmopolitan state, which cooperatively domesticates economic globalization, as well as guaranteeing the otherness of the other, this could certainly be or become a realistic utopia. A cosmopolitan Europe of national differences, what does this mean, for example, with regard to Great Britain? In my opinion, in the islanders' Europe skepticism, it is not the insistence on their own national civilization that deserves criticism, but rather their inability to recognize that a cosmopolitan Europe does not cancel it out, but rather cherishes it. Europe would not be Europe without the British idea of civilization. The most important historical event of the 20th century, the defeat of the National Socialist terror, would have been inconceivable without the British determination to defend Europe values in Europe against the Germans in their fascist terror. This is a product of British history, a part of British cosmopolitanism, and a founding act of the new Europe, which must be treasured, not dismissed. Similarly, it is necessary to discover cosmopolitan France, cosmopolitan Germany, cosmopolitan Italy, Poland, Spain, Greece, and so on. Seventh thesis. This idea of a cosmopolitan state transferable to other regions of the world, the new state option of a cosmopolitan interactive and reflexive state which seeks to reconstitute its power at the intersection of global, regional, and local systems of rule and governance is emerging wherever previously there was only the alternative of either national and thus state self-determination or submission within national state authority. The architecture of a cosmopolitan state union could point a way out of the politics of false alternatives, in particularly in regions of chronic ethnic national state conflicts, the insoluble conflict between Israelis and Palestinians comes into mind, or in the face of the threat of annexation, as it is in the case of Hong Kong or Taiwan by China. In the case of Israel, this would assume that Israel reimports its cosmopolitan tradition, the diasporic consciousness, a consciousness of Jewish collective as one sharing territory with others, devoid of exclusiveness and hegemonic power. Eighth and last thesis. The enemies of cosmopolitization are easily to identify and apparently all-powerful. But who would qualify as a barrier and supporter of such a cosmopolitan transformation? Modern nationalism was born out of the emergent national capitalism. Could modern cosmopolitanism emerge as a creation of global capitalism? Or is it vice versa, that radicalized global capitalism destroys the preconditions and sources of cultural diversity, bindings, and political freedom? Is it at all conceivable that a cosmopolitan capitalism could rise to become a factor in the cosmopolitan revival of democracy? I know this would put the socialist perspective of the Workers' International upside down. Would it be even possible to forge that sub-politics of investment decisions into an instrument of power with the goal of establishing global rules for wild capitalism on the one hand, and on the other to force nation-state to open up to cosmopolitanism? Is it at all conceivable that the right to strike will be transferred from the labor movement to an employees' movement and become a cosmopolitan investment politics, serving not only the purpose of advertising, but also rewriting constitutions, democracy, and justice in alliance with regulating cooperating transnational states? Or does this merely raise false hopes and false consciousness once again? It is well known that in the social science, there's nothing more risky than making a prognosis, especially in behalf of the future. Whoever focuses, however, on the increase in power of global economy can indeed derive experimentally a short-term and a long-term prognosis. In the short term, the protectionistic forces may triumph. It is a heterogeneous mix of nationalists, anti-capitalists, environmentalists, defenders of national democracy and of the authority of the nation state, as well as xenophobic groupings and religious fundamentalists. On the long term, however, a paradoxical coalition between the supposed losers of the integration of global economy, trade unions, environmentalists, Democrats, and the winners, big business, financial markets, world trade organizations, etc., may indeed lead to a cosmopolitan renewal of the political, provided that both sides recognize that their specific interests are best served by cosmopolitan rules. Then advocates of workers' rights, environmentalists, and defenders of democracy will support a cosmopolitan legal system. This, however, also goes for globally active business. At the end of the day, they can also only be economically successful in a framework that guarantees themselves and others legal, political, and social security. Ultimately, only the cosmopolitan extension of state, politics, justice, and democracy can guarantee the profit interest of business. But, as we all know, ultimately we are all dead. Still, the only way to make a cosmopolitan vision possible is, as Immanuel Kant taught almost 200 years ago, to act as if it were possible. Let me close with an ironic quote from George Bernard Shaw. The reasonable man adapts himself to the world. The unreasonable man persists in trying to adapt the world to himself. Therefore, all progress depends on the unreasonable man.
Thank you for your attention.
We've got about a quarter of an hour for questions and discussion. There should be roving mics somewhere around in the auditorium. Can I ask you to speak slowly and clearly, or speak in German when you ask your questions, or possibly both of those things at the same time? Ulrich, I'll leave you to pick out who you want to select from the audience.
There's so many questions that I'm not able to pick anyone else. Who's going to be the first?
Maybe get closer.
I know you're picking up phrase I'm using in my book on work, but it's hard to relate it to my lecture I gave right now. Indeed, I think that one of the problems we are facing in trying to capture the future scenarios in whatever parts of the world we live in is that the Western point of view doesn't have any strong relationship to what is going to be the future. There are all kind of different developments, even in the third world or in countries like Brazil, may even picture or reflect the future which we are facing in Western Europe as well. So at this book, I'm saying that even in Western countries like Britain and Germany, the degree of fragile employment is on the rise in an extreme way. One third of the population of the working population in Germany is under fragile conditions now. In Britain, it's even more, and in the United States, it is even more again. So if we want to find out what this really means, we have to look at countries who are experienced in fragile work than more than the Western countries are. And this was the reason why I said, well, let's look, for example, at Brazil at some point in order to find out what conditions those fragile work really create and how we can react to it. But as I said, it's hard to relate it to the lecture, what I gave to my lecture. Please. Well, I tried to touch those subjects at least on a few elements. I hope I didn't draw a too positive picture of the new meta power of global capital, since all the negative elements are there as well. The weakening of state structures, of democratic structures, the loss of tax income, of tax revenue, as you said. And what I think, what I feel is very important, it's a kind of power which is to some extent what I call translegal. It's a kind of power which is not institutionalized, which is not accountable, where you don't have anybody, which is not democratic, which is ademocratic, and so on, but which is at the same time changing the political rules of nation policy and even of the international system. So I think there's a shift from democratic control, from the democratic control to power of power to more and more an ademocratic way of decision making, even collective binding decision making, where even the national politics and the national state only is the executive organ of a global reform policy. And I think this is actually very worrying because we are mostly talking of politics in terms of national state politics, and maybe there isn't so much politics going on in this arena. Parties are getting alike. It's not so much differences. Maybe there are big differences still, but a lot of politics is happening outside of the political arena, and even more than that, outside of democratic arena. And I think this is really worrying. Let me pick up your last question and then go on to the other questions you asked. Indeed, for example, Amnesty International doesn't have a democratic organizational structure, as maybe corporate firms don't have either, a structure like this. But if you ask younger people all over the world, by the way, who they value most and who they think are legitimate actors, you find that exactly those NGOs have the highest rank. So the legitimacy of NGOs is a matter of the public definition of the social construction of legitimacy in the perspective of a lot of people. And you can find, for example, that, on the other hand, I think, which is to me at least, of course, this is maybe very controversial in the discussion, the what I call the meta power of corporations is not based on any resource of state or democratic legitimation. So even the more power they have, the less they are trusted to some extent. And this trust is the trust of the public, and at the same time, the trust of the consumer. We find that the reaction of the consumer is very important. For example, if risk definitions come up, so global markets really are breaking down on those perceptions, on this deficit of legitimation. So it is a very effective weapon which the NGOs are using in order to politicize those conflicts in behalf of the global economy. And I think this is very important. elements of state power and what states of the monopoly of states like lawmaking are being really privatized, and there's a whole discussion on the subjects going on in the political science and the laws and international laws. Many people maybe know much more about this as I do. I'm only reading it. More and more problems of international negotiation, international cooperation between businesses, and the conditions under which this has been done and the conflicts which come up are organized in private corporations. And those private corporations are even challenging national law. And I think this is one of the main aspects where you can find that actually what constituted the state is now being privatized to some extent. But it is privatized, it's done very effectively to some extent, at least, what the literature says. But it is, as I try to say, it doesn't have the resources of legitimation the state has. So in case of conflict, in case of social conflict, of political conflict, they just can repeat, we are doing it on economical terms, we are doing it by economic rationality and so on, like the World Trade Organization does and the IMF does, but they don't have really a political argument behind it. They don't have any political legitimation. And this makes this kind of power in the perspective of a sociologist fragile. It's a high power without sources of legitimation. And this legitimation crisis of a meta power can be public criticized and public made public demonstrated by those conflicts on the market of the organized consumer who shows that he doesn't trust in what the company says. And I think this is a quite important paradox which gives NGOs a very good weapon against a very good strategy against those corporations, even if they are not very powerful.
Please. In your perspective, can your model of mega corporate power capitalism penetrate countries like North Korea, and if so, how?
Beg your pardon?
In your perspective, your notion of mega power and capitalism can penetrate countries like North Korea, where it's posed right now, and if so, how?
Did you get it?
What's its relevance to the situation of North Korea in relation to the situation of Korea?
Let me try. I'm not somebody who knows who can solve all the problems of the world. I didn't want to be ironical. Let me try to redefine it in terms of the German of Germany. The German Democratic Republic, the Communist Germany, broke down, and we had a reunion on the basis of a nation state, but we didn't even have a discussion as it came up nowadays between Hong Kong and China, of some kind, what I would call a cooperative, cosmopolitan state structure, two nations in one state system in Germany. This could have been quite an interesting solution, but nobody really thought about it. They only thought about different nation states or one big nation. And I think it would have been interesting. Where we are just having an experiment in thought now. We can't really go into details. It would have been interesting to not just think of two different traditions, one language, but two different traditions, political histories, in a model where one has is submitted and supposed to the other one. And indeed, if you think in terms like this, the reunification of North Korea and South Korea must not be thought only in a model of a nation state, but there could be maybe a transnational or a model two nations, one cooperative state, as this idea of this very vague idea, vague idea of a cosmopolitan states points out. Please. I think all of those.
Sorry.
No answers.
Actually, this was my answer. Well, I tried a more serious answer. I have a hard time of thinking of a person or a group to handle this problem. I think more of institutions we need and kind of groupings we need. Maybe this is a sociological bias. Of course, we need persons as well, but it's hard to. But maybe I don't know them. It would be interesting, for example, well, I think Europe is actually in a space where an experiment like this is happening nowadays, even if we don't define it in this way. We define it still as a huge nation, Europe sometimes, or a federal republic, like the German foreign minister did. It was really the German model he thought for Europe, or we define it as Europe of fatherlands and so on. But to go more in details, why don't we have, for example, European parties inside of nation states? Why don't we have a European public in the way that European issues are being picked up inside of national arenas and national publics? You know, we are pretty much, even if this Europe is it's getting closer. We still live. We already live in a European system to some extent, a European society. The societies are somehow separating more. I got the feeling, at least, there's not as much translation and not as much involvement in between going on. So we need actually institutions which translate and transform the affairs of one national public to another, in order to get involved in the European issues, not only on a transnational European level as it has been done now, but on a local level and the national level as well. I don't know if this answers your questions, but
I'll try another one anyway.
Yes, please. Oh, yeah.
Do you think that there can be a reconciliation between the notion of social Europe and the neoliberal consensus, which appears to be driving EU enlargement at the moment?
Could you repeat it again? I just had a trouble.
Do you think that there can be a reconciliation between the notion of social Europe and the neoliberal consensus, which appears to be driving EU enlargement?
No, I think this is a real contradiction. I think a social Europe, which I think to some extent is necessary in order to define a political Europe and to define a democratic Europe, is so far as I can see it is a contradiction of this social Europe with the main aspects of a neoliberal Europe, which is now under discussion. There has to be a change of politics in order to do this. As you may have noticed, I'm trying to make a distinction between a neoliberal globalization and a globalization which is being shaped by democratic and social points of views. And I think this policy is not being dominant in Europe so far. There are elements of it because we do have a discussion on the third way, which tries at least to develop some perspective of a social Europe as well. But they are not very influential so far. I don't know.
I think this is probably should be the last question anyway, because we have to
Here's one
finish.
More question over here. Well, once again, this is a big issue, of course, but I think a lot of problems and a lot of political decisions are nowadays being put on this level of transnational and global agencies and organizations, as the IFM and the World Bank. They have a life on their own. There's some decisive political institutions by themselves, even if they try to be related to the nation state. And indeed, I think this the policy of these institutions is very important, and it is important for the perspective of development policy as well. But it is not so far really open to global and cosmopolitan issues. And it is pretty much based on the neoliberal regime, and it would have to be transformed and translated to a more democratic and at the same time a more, as I tried to say, cosmopolitan politics, which gives the third world and many actors a greater part of participation in those decision-making processes.
Well, can I thank everyone again for coming this evening, and ask you to thank Ulrich for his characteristically wide-ranging lecture. Thanks very much, Ulrich.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. You got mine.